illustrious heroes and villains in the woods," said Annadel. "Children who have sought out candidates in floating mountains, cloud forests, piranha lakes, active volcanoes, ice castles, mermaid lagoons, elephant graveyards, and the belly of a very large whale," said Dot. "Children who will do whatever it takes to find the right person for the job, because this is our fairy tale quest," said Hester, demon tattoo twitching on her neck. "Wouldn't you rather be fighting a giant or elf prince so you can get your name in a storybook?" the vizier said, becoming serious. "This all feels like a leader sending their henchmen to get the job done, and that never turns out well." "Unless the leader knows we are the only people who can get the job done," said Hester, "because this is a quest that will shape good and evil for a long time to come, and our coven cares more about that than having our names in a storybook, which is precisely why Professor Dovey picked us in the first place. And if she, the dean of our enemy school, is willing to put the fate of the woods in our hands rather than her own or anyone else's, then I suggest you stop worrying about our ages and start worrying about how to best respect the students you so wisely expect to lead." The vizier gaped at her. "That's all," chimed Dot, turning a pea crisp to chocolate and flouncing with her friends out of his hut. A moment later, Dot shuffled back in. "Can you help us get down from this tree?" Dovey checked in with them each day at 1 o'clock, so the witches found a place to settle for lunch in Eternal Springs, a small jungle kingdom 15 miles from Kyrgios. Eternal Springs was populated entirely by animals, since it rained nearly every day of the year, and despite the abundance of greenery and food, no human or sentient creature wanted to live in a place that wet. As the witches waded through lush thickets and colourful flowers in their dumpy black dresses and boots, Hester could see deer, storks and squirrels watching them as if they were an eclipse of the sun. They'd been on foot most of these past 6 months, since the flower ground had restored only limited service after being ravaged during the previous schoolmaster's reign. Along the way, they'd seen wonderful, curious things. The kingdom of Kasatkina, ruled entirely by cats. The night pools in Netherwood, which brought your worst fears to life. The living library in Pifflepath Hills, which had ancestry scrolls on every soul in the woods, kept by a very large bat. And the caves of Contempo in Borna Coric, where time ran backwards. They'd even taken a ride aboard the legendary blue-boned Stimpf, from which they'd had a rare view of the Four Point, a small square plot of land at the intersection of four kingdoms. It was the site of King Arthur's last battle, where he'd been mortally wounded, and was now considered a truce mark between good and evil, explained Hester, who'd read about it in A Student's History of the Woods. Camelot's flag flew high over the land, whose boundaries were guarded by four walls made of rushing waterfalls, enchanted by the Lady of the Lake. If anyone got close enough that even a drop of water touched their skin, the lady would reach out and drown them. The girls had made sure to stay at a safe distance as they flew on to their next interview in Hamelin. But that was back when they'd first started, when the search for a schoolmaster was marvellous fun, no matter how tiring or dangerous. Endless travel in the summer heat had taken its toll. Dot had blisters and an aching lower back. Hester's demon had a perpetual frown, and even Annadil's albino white skin had the hint of a tan. At least they were safe here in Eternal Springs, if a little damp, and after 6 months of crossing in and out of new kingdoms, all in pursuit of the best possible candidates they could take back to their dean, well, safety was about as much as they could ask for. Finding a spot under a well-canopied palm, Hester whipped up a lunch of avocados and custard apples that she'd snapped off trees, while Annadil cracked open a few coconuts filled with sweet water, and Dot spread out sheets of crumpled old newspaper she'd dug out of her bag, so they wouldn't have to sit in wet dirt. For 10 minutes, they ate silently as rain spritzed around them, the three witches lost in their own heads, before they came out of their fugue all at once, like best friends often do.
"I thought this last one was the most promising so far," Annadil said, watching her rats wrestle over a dead caterpillar.
"P-man," Dot snarfled, mouth full.
"Calm, reasonable. I can see him in the schoolmaster's tower," Annadil continued, slurping coconut water. "Even more than the ice giant from Frost Plains, the fairy rights activist from Gillikin, or that monkey king from Runyon Mills." "None of them have been right," muttered Hester. "We can do better." "At some point we have to pick someone, Hester. It's been 6 months, said Annadil. "Without a schoolmaster, the Storian is vulnerable. So are the woods."
"I liked the Augur of Ladleflop," said Dot. "He told me I was pretty."
"He was blind," snapped Annadil.
"Oh, P-Man was better then," said Dot.
"We have to pick someone by the wedding,"
Annadil resolved, giving Hester a wary look.
"We're not missing the wedding, right?"
Hester paused, picking at her food before looking up.
"No, we're not missing the wedding."
Annadil sighed softly. "No letters from Agatha in months, though," Dot said, sliding off her boots. "Not since the one where she pretended like everything at Camelot was peaches and roses. Hope the wedding's still on."
"Dovey would have told us if it wasn't," said Annadil.
"I knew we should have been at the coronation. Maybe we could have stopped everything from going belly up," said Dot.
"Finding a new schoolmaster was more important than watching Tedros make an ass of himself again," said Hester, pulling back her red and black hair. "I'm sure he'll give a repeat performance in 2 months."
"The wedding's that soon," Dot said.
"Here comes the wedding diet. Let me guess, everything you touch will turn to kimchi,"
Annadil cracked. "No, ma'am. No more diets. I've been fat, I've been thin. Fat is better, no matter what Daddy says," Dot piped, digging into her chocolate avocado pudding. "I just mean time is going fast and we haven't found a schoolmaster yet." They suddenly noticed Hester had gone quiet, squinting at her food.
"Hester?"
Dot prodded. Hester lifted her half-eaten avocado and studied the newspaper beneath the dish.
"How old is this paper?"
"Got it in Gillikin. So, like, 3 weeks ago?"
said Dot. Hester leaned in, inspecting the headlines on the crusty parchment. Pirates take over ports in Jaunt Joli, numbers growing. Kidnapping foiled in Rainbow Gale. Fire at Glass Mountain Orchard. Her stomach twisted. Every single headline involved one of their classmates' quests. Beatrix was leading the charge against vicious pirates in Jaunt Joli. Vex and Mona were supposed to kidnap the seer of Rainbow Gale, who'd been helping Evers cheat their happy endings. Kiko was with the group tending the consecrated orchard atop Glass Mountain. And from the headlines, it didn't sound like any of it was going well.
"What's wrong?"
Anadil asked, her rats peeking up from their meal. Hester put her own food down, obscuring the parchment. No use worrying her friends over old news. Besides, was it her fault if her classmates were incompetent twits and failing their missions? Right now, she had her own quest to worry about. She turned to her friends.
"Are you sure we're asking the right questions?"
"You mean, should we be asking candidates if they like candlelit dinners and walks on the beach?"
said Anadil.
"After 6 months, 80 interviews, and I don't know how many nights listening to Dot fart in her sleep, now you're wondering if we're asking the right questions?"
"It was those lentil cakes in Drupathy," Dot lamented.
"I just keep thinking about what Lady Lesso would do if she was here," Hester said, "because it feels like everyone we meet is saying exactly what we want to hear. Like, how do we know Mr. Calm and Reasonable won't turn into psychotic Rafal the moment he gets near the Storian?"
Dot and Anadil had no defense.
"Look, I know some are definitely better than others," said Hester. "But this is the future schoolmaster we're talking about. The protector of the pen that rules all our lives. And we can't make a mistake."
"But we also can't read their minds," pushed Anadil. "And the longer we wait, the more chance there is that someone swoops in and tries to fill the schoolmaster's place on his own. Someone as bad as Rafal. Or worse. And then who are the woods going to turn to for help? The King of Camelot, like they used to? Tedros? You think he can lead? You think he can unite good and evil? He couldn't even get through his own coronation."
Hester watched her avocado turn black.
"Besides, it's not like we're making the final decision. We just have to give Dovey a shortlist. The final decision is up to her,"
Anadil persisted.
"It's up to both, Deans," Hester shot back. "Do you really want Sophie picking the next schoolmaster after she fell in love with the last one?"
He'd be pretty at least," Dot mused. "Sophie does have good taste in men."
Hester gave her a putrid look.
"What? It's true," Dot said. "She's probably sneaking gorgeous Everboys into evil as we speak."
"Maybe the old Sophie would have,"
Anadil countered.
"But she's Dean now. She's the face of evil."
"Annie's right. She has changed," Hester admitted. "I mean, we hated her as Dean those last months of school, but she really did seem happy without a boy."
"For now," said Dot.
"For now,"
Anadil conceded. And from what Dovey's told us, she's getting worse, said Dot, moving into the schoolmaster's tower, adding beach cabanas to Halfway Bay, turning the Doom Room into a dance club on Saturday nights, morphing the castle into a living memorial to herself. Sounds like she's starting to push boundaries, just like P-Man said. I mean, how long before she decides she needs a date to Agatha's wedding? Hester and Anadil goggled at her. Hello? You don't think Sophie would show up alone, do you? To her best friend's wedding? To a king? Dot asked. Hester looked at Anadil.
Every once in a while she says something worth thinking about.
Not enough to keep her around, said Anadil.
Next time I'm eating all the lentil cakes, Dot huffed. Suddenly, a tiny spray of white light appeared above them, as if the air had ripped open, giving them a peek into a new dimension. The light distended and wobbled like a sack of water before it slowly took the shape of a circle, and Professor Dovey's face appeared in the middle, blinking at them from inside a crystal ball.
"Girls, I have news," she said breathlessly.
Immediately Hester noticed something was wrong. Dovey's eyes were rimmed red, her hair frazzled and greasy, and the lines around her mouth rutted deep. Her office was a mess, littered with newspapers and scrolls. The gold vial that Dovey had recently been wearing around her neck was now empty, and there was a map floating in the air like a wandering balloon, covered in red lettering Hester couldn't make out. There was even a food stain on the dean's green gown, which made Hester think the situation was dire indeed, since no one had ever seen Professor Dovey look anything but spotless.
Are you okay, Professor?
Hester asked, struggling to muster sympathy, an emotion she didn't really have. Though she had zero respect for fairy godmothers, and Dovey had been Cinderella's before becoming Good's dean, the fact Dovey trusted them with this mission had softened Hester's opinion of her. She'd even begun to see Clarissa Dovey as a friend.
"You look a little,
"Girls, your quest is over for now," Professor Dovey declared. "I need you to return to school."
The witches gasped.
"You can't do that,"
Dot started.
"After all, we've..."
Anadil overlapped. Hester cut them off.
"Professor, I know we haven't brought you a short list of candidates, but we're working like dogs to find someone we believe in, and trust me when I say we're all deeply grateful for this responsibility."
"Hester," said Professor Dovey.
"You can trust us to finish the job. Please don't punish us by taking our quest away, not when we're finally starting to figure out..." "Hester!"
Professor Dovey snapped.
"This is not about punishing you. On the contrary, I have complete faith in your abilities. That's why I need your help on an urgent matter. A matter that supersedes all else."
Hester stared at her.
"But what can be more urgent than finding a new schoolmaster?"
Behind Dovey, the door to her office swung open, and Professor Emma Anemone peeked beneath the floating map, slathered in a green beauty mask.
"Clarissa, do you mind if I attend Dean Sophie's dance this evening? Given how many of our students are going, and with Princess Uma still on leave, surely someone from Good should be..."
"Not now, Emma!"
the dean barked. Professor Anemone fled.
Professor Dovey,
Hester started. I don't have time for questions, Hester. I need you to return to the castle at once. The peony line on the flower ground is up and running from Eternal Springs and can get you back by nightfall.
Of course. Anything to help?
Hester said feebly, still upset their quest would be cut short.
But can I at least ask, is this about Sophie?
And ever, boys, said Dot.
Oh, shut it, Dot,
Hester ripped.
Girls, our troubles are far bigger than the antics of a fellow dean,
Professor Dovey said, glancing up anxiously at the magic map. But I will say this. She leaned in, glaring hard into the crystal ball.
I'm hoping you can take care of two birds with one stone.
Chapter 5. Agatha. Intervention.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, buttocks in, child, and head up. You're waltzing, not scouring the floor for lost coins.
Pollux barked at Agatha, his dog's head attached to a fat sheep's carcass. Wobbling around the Gold Tower ballroom, Pollux kept time with a willow stick, as Agatha danced with the skeletal, red-haired altar boy who'd made a spectacle of himself at Tedros's coronation.
Don't rush, girl. 1, 2, 3. And stop gripping Willem like he's the last lifeboat out of Ooty. And smile, Agatha. This isn't a devil's haunt. Dance like this, and you'll be egged at your own wedding.
How are you even here? Agatha growled, exasperated by her clumsy feet, her hapless partner, and the return of a prissy, scant-furred, snub-nosed canine she thought she'd left behind at school. Pollux was one half of a two-headed Cerberus who taught at the school for good and routinely lost the battle to use the body to his evil brother, Castor. Which meant that whenever the two siblings were apart, Pollux had to find dead animals to attach his own head to, in this case, a rotting ewe.
Clarissa Dovey and I had a falling out, Pollux sniffed. After Sophie was appointed Dean of Evil, I encouraged Clarissa to consider her own succession plan, just as her friend Lady Lesso did before her untimely death. As I explained to Dean Dovey, not only is she ripe in age, but it's time for good to have a fresh face at the fore, rather than one sagging past its prime. Of course, I pointed this out in the most tactful manner. But Clarissa ignored my many missives. Spine straight! He swatted Willem with the stick, and the boy yelped. So I circulated a petition advocating for a mandatory retirement age, which Dean Dovey is well past. Naturally, I also nominated myself to replace her, but the shrew caught wind of the plan and had me fired.
Pollux jabbed Agatha with his stick. Agatha snapped it in two and handed it back to him.
I see royal life has done nothing for your attitude.
Pollux glowered.
Do you want your wedding to be as pathetic as the coronation? Imagine the royal rot, worst bride ever. Is that what you want, Agatha? More embarrassment?
Agatha's anger fizzled.
No. Good. because when Lady Gremlane heard of my travails at school, she brought me here to help you," said Pollux, "specifically to teach dance, etiquette, and history in preparation for your wedding. She's even planning to make me your permanent steward, given your need for constant supervision."
"Stewards are for kids," Agatha frowned. "I won't need a steward once I'm officially queen. Only you can't be officially queen until Tedros is officially king. And right now, there's a sword hanging over that prospect,"
Pollux said, gazing through the ballroom window at Excalibur, sticking out from a blue tower balcony across the catwalk. Two royal guards stood on either side. Pollux met Agatha's eyes.
"So, until your dear unofficial king finds a way to pull that sword and seal his coronation, he has Lady Gremlane watching his every move, and you have me."
Agatha nearly retched. Willem stepped hard on her toe. "Ow!" Agatha blared, knocking Willem into Pollux.
"Who needs a wedding when you can have a circus?"
Pollux scowled. After two more insufferable hours, Agatha moved to etiquette training, where she had to learn the names of 1,600 wedding guests from fat albums of portraits, with Pollux spraying her with stinging lemon juice every time she missed one.
"For the last time, who is this?"
Pollux crabbed, pointing at a hook-nosed face.
"The Baron of Hodgebodge," Agatha said confidently. "Baroness! Baroness!" Pollux yelled.
Agatha goggled at him. "That's a woman." By then she was dripping in lemon juice, still distracted by the sight of the sword in the balcony and unable to focus on anything else. Thankfully, the dog was interrupted by a courier crow with a message from Castor, which gave Agatha time to think. She'd always assumed that Tedros would pull Excalibur from the stone eventually. Sooner or later, he'd jolt the blade free, or he'd figure out it was a clue to another puzzle or riddle, and then he'd solve it. She'd yet to consider that Tedros might never complete his father's coronation test. That the sword might stubbornly hang in that balcony for the rest of their lives. An eternal reminder of his failure. In which case, Tedros would never feel like a true king. He'd be trapped in this cycle of shame and isolation, so different from the gallant, open-hearted boy who'd once looked to her as his partner. "But what can I do to help him?" Agatha thought, gazing out the window at the rain. This wasn't like a trial by tale at school, where she could sneak in to save him. The sword was Tedros's test, and his alone. And yet, if she could help him somehow, wouldn't that fix everything? Agatha watched the storm gust across the castle. Something caught her eye through the rain. Agatha leaned over the windowsill to get a closer look. Across the catwalk, a boy had emerged onto the blue tower balcony in beige breeches and a grey hooded shirt, with the hood pulled over his head. He dismissed the guards and stood there all alone, drenched clothes clinging to his muscular frame. He peeked around to make sure no one was watching. Agatha ducked out of sight.
before he began stretching each of his arms and shaking the tension out of his legs. Then, with a deep breath, he gripped Excalibur by the hilt and began to pull. The past 6 months, she'd watched Tedros do this every night. The same skulking onto the balcony, the same dismissing of the guards, the same diligent warm-up before he did battle with his father's sword. In the beginning, there had been swordmasters, blacksmiths, and ex-knights who coached him as he pulled, while Lady Gremlane looked on with narrowed eyes. Back then, the kingdom had been on the verge of war, with half the people supporting Tedros as king and half calling for his deposal. 6 months later, both sides had settled into a stagnant détente. The trapped sword, a symbol of a king they were stuck with. Now, there were no more coaches or watchful stewards. But still, Tedros tried at the sword again and again. This was the first time Agatha had ever seen him during the day, though, for he'd always waited until the sun was down, when no one beyond the castle would be able to spot him. Perhaps he thought the storm was camouflage enough, or perhaps today he didn't care who saw him as he heaved and sweated, ripping at the blade from every angle. Excalibur didn't budge. This too was part of the routine, and Tedros would react to defeat like he had every day these past 6 months, by getting up at dawn and working out even harder, as if it was his strength that was failing him, and nothing else. Truth was, Agatha had never seen him so strong, ripped muscles stretching his shirt like he could shot-put a ship out of the ocean. He tore at the hilt with his new strength, bright blood streaking his palms, dripping down steel, before he threw back his head and let out a single, futile cry. Agatha closed her eyes and exhaled. When she opened them, he was looking right at her. She could hardly make out his face through the lashes of rain, but he was frozen still, gazing at her from beneath his hood. It was a dead, empty look, as if their shared past had been erased. As if this was the first time he'd ever seen her. "You won't learn the Empress of Putsi's name by mooning into the rain," a voice said. Agatha turned to see Pollux and his sheep corpse lording over her. He glared down at her soggy album, a mess of runny colours. "I know you're not one for ceremony or celebration or nice things, Agatha, but this is your wedding," said Pollux. "And I thought it was a leprechaun's ball," she said. "If you're going to treat this as a joke, then maybe I should call Lady Gremlane. Run to Mummy, like you always do. You are a sad little girl," Pollux retorted. "Says the dog puppeting a sheep." Pollux sighed. "I'm not here to torture you, Agatha. I'm here to help you get married. You have to care."
"I care," Agatha said quietly.
"You have to care, because it's a timeless tradition, and because it's the first time your people will see you as a queen."
"I care," Agatha repeated.
"You have to care, because this is your legacy."
"I care," Agatha said.
"Do you?" said Pollux incredulously. Based on what I see, you don't. Tell me why I should believe you care about your wedding.
Agatha looked at him. Because I need to remind Tedros that we were happy once.
Sorrow softened Pollux's face. Agatha turned back to the rain, hoping her prince was still there. But all she could see were two guards, wiping his blood off a sword. Agatha ate dinner in the Queen's bathroom, where no one could bother her. She still had her wedding history lesson, but Pollux let her eat before it, without alerting her chambermaids, a clear breach of protocol, since they had to know where the princess was at all hours. Instead, Agatha had barreled into the kitchen herself, sending 10 cooks into coronary shock.
Princess Agatha,
Chef Silkema gasped, her rich brown skin flecked with flour.
What's happened? Is everything all right?
Can I get spaghetti with cheese for dinner? Said Agatha. Lots of cheese, tons, like enough to ruin the dish.
Chef Silkema and the cooks gaped down at their finished platters of cumin-spiced coconut soup, curried chicken in a green chili sauce, potato tikis with peas and scallions, black lentil salad with salmon crumbs, and a 5-layer kulfi pistachio cake.
Spaghetti with cheese?
Chef Silkema croaked. To go, please, said Agatha. One of the cooks dropped his spoon. Now, as she sat dangling bare feet into a bathtub of hot water, surrounded by mirrors and peeling gold wallpaper, Agatha twirled creamy white spaghetti from a porcelain bowl into her mouth, savouring the melted mozzarella. Everyone had their comfort in times of stress. Sophie had sea salt facials, juice fasts, yoga poses and deep tissue massages. Tedros had dumbbells and climbing ropes and anything to work up a sweat. Agatha had food. More precisely, so much food that it induced a warm, velvety coma that dulled her senses and made her unable to think beyond the gurgles of her stomach. Reaper moseyed into the bathroom and sniffed at a scrap of cheese. He gave Agatha a curdled look, as if he thought she'd outgrown all this, and shuffled away. Agatha and Tedros had certainly had fights before. Fights that made Agatha doubt whether he loved her or she loved him, or whether they even belonged together. But this wasn't a fight. She was sure Tedros loved her now, or at least as sure as she could be. Except relationships aren't just about love, Agatha realized. Relationships are about taking off the mask you wear to make someone like you and letting them see the real you. The one you hid all along. The one you never thought was good enough to find love in the first place. Tedros had helped her peel off her mask in her years at school. He'd seen her at her most vulnerable and her absolute worst, and loved her even more for it. But now it was Tedros's turn to do the same, and he was acting like most boys do when asked to face their feelings. They run. There was another thing that also made this rift different than the others, Agatha thought, spotting the pile of letters on her desk. She could see the latest one, which she'd read so many times, yet left unanswered.
Darling, I know you're not reading this, I know you're not reading any of my letters. You're in love and have a wedding to plan and have no time for silly old me. But if you do read this, just know that you are in my heart always. And living without you has been far harder than I could ever admit out loud. So let me say it here. I miss you. Love, Sophie. P.S. Did you know Hort has been getting love letters from a girl? Agatha wiped her eyes. Back at school, she'd always had Sophie by her side, the third point in the triangle between her and Tedros. A hollow loneliness overwhelmed her, and for the first time she saw it wasn't just her old, chivalrous prince she was yearning for, but her bold, beautiful best friend, too. A best friend she'd been avoiding, just like Tedros had been avoiding her. Now, she was all alone. Outside, she heard wind and rain batter the ships in the harbour. Glancing through a small window, she saw none of these ships could sail. They were broken, neglected, and falling apart, like the rest of Camelot. Well, not all the ships. There was one that looked sturdy, with brilliant blue and gold finishes and milky white sails. Along the bow, she read the ship's name. Igraine.
Agatha? Pollux's voice echoed outside. Shall we resume our...
A loud hissing noise interrupted, followed by dog barks and crashing furniture. Pollux had met Reaper. 20 minutes later, Agatha was in the library, a two-story collection in the Gold Tower that must have once been impressive, but was now a heap of cobwebs, moth-eaten books, and so much dust she could hardly breathe. There were colourful sheets slung over the bookcases and desks as if someone had started renovating a decade ago and never got around to finishing. Agatha slouched at a desk shrouded in a purple sheet, trying to take notes as Pollux scrawled on a squeaky chalkboard, his face slashed with claw marks, suggesting he'd lost the battle with her cat.
You certainly don't want to be like Princess Kerber, who was so overwrought on her wedding day she ate an entire jar of peanut butter and vomited on her poor groom's shoes. Conversely, learn from the example of Princess Muguruza, who married a commoner, nearly prompting a revolt until she revealed her bridal gown made entirely out of pink pearls she dredged from the savage sea. No one dared attack a girl who'd braved such treacherous waters, and in time, every last dissenter forgave her.
Agatha glazed over, her head drooping into the purple sheet. She tried to force herself awake, prying her eyes open. That's when she saw the pattern stitched on the fabric. Tiny, silver, five-pointed stars in a purple night sky, like they'd been drawn by a child. It wasn't a sheet at all. It was a cape. Agatha held in a smile, her eyes on Pollux's back. She put her nose to the purple velvet and inhaled the scent of fresh cocoa, as if someone was brewing it right now.
Then there was Princess Mahalaxmi, whose father kidnapped her during the ceremony and sold her to a never-warlord in Ravenbow, Pollux rattled, which goes to show all family entanglement should be sorted before the wedding.
Agatha rose from her chair, careful not to make a sound, and slipped her palms into the cape, vanishing her hands like a magic trick. Then her arms, then her shoulders.
I don't hear your pen, Agatha. This is for your own good.
Pollux tutted. But by the time he turned, all that remained of his student was a single clump, somehow left behind. The moment Agatha put her face through the cape, she felt herself swaddled in velvet, then plummeting through darkness, pulses of blinding white light streaking by. She closed her eyes and let herself free fall, her arms raised, her one-shoed feet splayed, her mind untethering from her thoughts, her fears, until at last she crashed face first into something fluffy and soft and tasted sweet cloud in her mouth. Agatha opened her eyes and craned up to a purple night sky lit by thousands of silvery five-pointed stars, as if the childish pattern on the cape in the library had come to life in heavenly dimension. The Celestium, Tedros once called it. The place where wizards go to think. Agatha rose to her knees and saw there was indeed a wizard peering thinkingly at her, sitting cross-legged on the cloud with purple silk robes, a droopy cone hat, horn-rimmed spectacles, and soft-furred violet slippers. Merlin, she smiled.
Sorry to interrupt your lessons, dear girl, but I'm afraid we have more important ones at the moment, the old wizard said, sipping at a mug of cream-topped cocoa. First, tell me, do you want whipped cream in your chocolate, provided my hat complies? A third mug of cocoa might be too much to ask. He's been rather insubordinate of late, insisting on a minimum wage and a month of paid vacation.
A third? Asked Agatha, confused. But there's only you and me here.
Goodness, you two really do have a hard time seeing eye to eye, don't you?
Merlin murmured. He leaned back, revealing a boy sitting next to him who'd been obscured by the wizard's profile. Tedros didn't look at Agatha. He held his own undrunk mug of chocolate, heaped with cream and rainbow sprinkles, his bare legs dangling off the cloud. He wore a sleeveless white undershirt and pajama shorts, his gold king's crown sunken into his wet hair.
Agatha and I have work to do, Merlin. Not that you would know, since you've been gone for half a year, but we're in charge of a kingdom now, Tedros said, dumping his steaming mug over the cloud. Our coffers are empty. We have no knights. Mother and Lance are missing. There's unrest all over the woods. We don't have time for a wizard's games.
You used to share your chocolate with Agatha. Now you're wasting it.
Merlin upbraided him.
I didn't ask for chocolate,
said Tedros, yanking his crown tighter.
I'm too old to be bribed with sweets.
But not too old to let your dear princess go hungry?
Merlin asked. I'm stuffed from dinner, said Agatha, trying to play both sides.
Where's the girl's cocoa?
The wizard bellowed into his hat.
You can't keep me here all night, Tedros scorned. Air's too thin in the Celestium.
I can keep you here until you're as white-haired as me. I'll just turn you into a goldfish and put you in a bowl. Agatha can feed you, said Merlin, giving his hat a good shake. That is, if she doesn't dump your food off a cloud.
The hat spat chocolate at Merlin, who promptly sat on the hat in return.
"Now, let's begin,"
the wizard harumphed.
"Begin what?" asked Agatha. "We don't need this, Merlin," Tedros hounded.
"Need what?" asked Agatha.
"You need this more than your obsessive workouts and overdeveloped stomach muscles," said Merlin, sitting harder on his squirming hat.
"You don't know anything about me any more," Tedros snapped. "You disappeared when I needed you, like you always do. Haven't sent so much as a postcard in 6 months, and then drop in acting like you can help me when you don't have the faintest clue. Just go back to whatever hole you were hiding in."
"Because you were doing such a fine job as king without me," said the wizard.
Tedros snarled. "My father was right to banish you from the castle."
"Well, you're certainly seeming more and more like him each day," said Merlin.
"Stop it! You're squabbling like hens, the both of you," Agatha yelled, echoing into the night. "What is this? What are we doing? Why are we here?"
The two men gaped at her sheepishly. But it was the hat that spoke from beneath Merlin's rump, scowling at them all.
"Couples therapy."
Chapter 6. Tedros. Two theories. Somewhere inside, Tedros knew this would happen. He couldn't continue the way he'd been going, treating Agatha like a distant cousin while wrestling his own demons down, down, down into the basement of his soul. These past 6 months, he'd told himself it was the only way forward, that Agatha was best left to the hopeful, happy duties of wedding planning while he reassured his castle staff that Camelot would return to glory. But he could only lie to himself for so long. There was nothing reassuring about his guards looking at him with pity and doubt, their eyes darting to his sword, jammed in a balcony. And there was nothing hopeful or happy about a princess planning a wedding to a boy who was doing everything he could to avoid her. Someone had to intervene. Someone had to save him from himself. But now it was happening, and he wasn't ready. The worst part was that he'd been through this before. Only he'd been the one ignored and abandoned. He'd been the one in Agatha's place. He was 9 years old. His mother had fled the castle with Lancelot, deserting both him and his father. But right when he needed his dad most, his father turned to drink instead, slowly poisoning himself rather than admit how much pain he was in. He'd begged his father to stop, but Arthur insisted it was Tedros's mother who needed help, not him. Yet in the end, it was his mother who'd been honest with herself, giving her a second chance at life, while his father numbed his feelings all the way to the grave. Now, sitting with Agatha and Merlin, Tedros felt his own buried pain return. He didn't want Agatha to suffer the way he once did, shut out by someone she loved. And he didn't want to be like his father, refusing help until it was too late.
"I thought everything was going to be okay when we left school," he said finally, unable to look at his princess. "I didn't want her to worry for the rest of her life. She's been through enough. But then I saw her watching me this morning when I was on the balcony, and I could see she was hurting."
"She?"
Meaning me? Agatha asked. Tedros saw Merlin squeeze Agatha's wrist, telling her this wasn't her turn to talk.
Merlin, where were you all this time?
Tedros said, clearing his throat.
No one's seen you since the coronation, not that I really saw you then either.
I'd hope not. It took a meticulous spell to turn me into a mosquito that could last a decent amount of time without sucking someone's blood,
said Merlin. Too bad it couldn't be Lady Gremlane's, Agatha offered. The wizard frowned at her.
You watched the coronation as a mosquito?
Tedros asked.
I was hoping to avoid detection and have all attention be on you, my boy. If anyone saw me, they would have foolishly tried to execute me, and it would have led to quite the spectacle indeed. But then you created your own spectacle by presenting your mother and Lancelot to the people against all reasonable advice. It was a stunning act of stubbornness, something a swaggering boy at school would do rather than a new king trying to build faith with his kingdom.
And I'm sorry for it, Tedros said softly. I thought it was the right thing at the time. I could have helped, Agatha started. Merlin's hat bit her bottom.
Maybe I did do everything wrong and messed it all up. Maybe I am the worst king in the world. But isn't that punishment enough?
Tedros fought. You didn't have to punish me too by disappearing for 6 months.
Punish you?
Merlin said aghast.
Tedros, dear, I've been gone keeping 2 people you love safe.
Tedros gaped, suddenly understanding. You were with Mom and Lance. I've been going crazy trying to track them. I got these mysterious cards from different parts of the woods.
And she would have sent far more, had I let her,
said Merlin. I knew it. There wasn't anything written on them, but they smelled like honeysuckle, which she knows is my favorite. Where are they? When can I see them? I need to see them.
Patience, boy. Your mother and Lancelot still have Arthur's rich bounty on their heads. A bounty you can't rescind until you pull the sword and finish your test. Getting them to safety was difficult enough. As soon as they were dragged into the castle at the coronation, I turned them into fruit flies and hustled them into the endless woods. We couldn't return to the old safe house in Avalon. The tale of Sophie and Agatha had revealed its existence to our whole world, which meant Avalon Island would be crawling with your mother's enemies. So to both hide your mother and Lancelot and distract them from worrying about you, I took them on a tour of kingdoms they'd never seen. Given their years of exile, we travelled by enchanted ship. The Igraine, which obeys any Lady of Camelot, princess or queen, and can fly through the air or turn invisible on that lady's command. Soon news started spreading of what happened at the coronation, with wanted posters for Guinevere and Lancelot tacked up everywhere we went. I had to be creative about disguising them. But that, as you know, is a specialty.
So they're safe? Tedros asked anxiously.
The Igraine is returned to Camelot Harbour, and your mother and Lance are hidden close by, rested and at ease.
except for the fact they're missing you. Well, your mother more than Lancelot.
The wizard winked.
Hope you disguised Lance as a girl.